Do you hear me? Yes. Okay, so it seems that the previous recording stopped before I had finished. So I will repeat the last part. So I will assume that we were here, Model 2. So I said that we had created a table, incident investigation, quality table, that it assumed that as the number of incidents investigated became higher and higher, here we have the ratio 1 to the capacity, here 2, twice as many incidents, here 3, here 4, here 5, so the quality of the investigation goes down. Then, and that's computed by the ratio between the incident investigation rate and the existing investigation capacity. We simulate, then the decrease in incident rates is lower than before. The number of incidents detected peaks higher, and the hump is wider. The effects are not so dramatic because we are assuming that the attack rate is constant over time. In reality, it will not. It would increase. So you can experiment with a model that I will upload to Fronta and see what happens if you make dramatic increases in the number of attacks. In the third model, adding the solution loop, the way I did it is that I created, I make the incident investigation capacity a stock that could be changed by allocating more resources. I define the desired investigation capacity as the maximum, as the incidents divided by the time to investigate incidents, or incidents investigation capacity. Why as the maximum? Well, because if we are having few incidents, and we made the incidents divided by time to capacity to investigate incidents the desired one, then we will have a low level. So, in this way, the desired investigation capacity is at least equal to the original incident investigation capacity, and when the incidents grow, then you add more resources. So that means that this, which was originally just a variable, now it's a stock. We have the desired investigation capacity, and here more capacity is allocated. So you get here the added loop that adds resources as needed. And when you simulate, here you compare the results of Model 3 with Model 2. So, for instance, incident rate, you see here and there, with blue color and green color. But in the first case, it's for Model 3. The second one is for the previous model. And you can see that with the solution loop, the incidents go faster down than if we don't have solution loop. Or similarly here, the number of incidents when we have the solution loop can allocate resources is the thick blue curve. If we cannot, we have the red one, which results in more incidents over time for about two months, you are having significant number of incidents more all the time. Okay, so what I do is that this is will be uploaded to Fronta along with the VNC models, so you can play with them. Okay. Questions? Good. Then, next post here in the front page for the class. incident reporting systems. I think I will skip this. I don't know if I have time enough today, but you could read that. The document about incident reporting systems tell you what it was about. And then there are, I think, two articles, Overcoming Organizational Challenge to Secure Knowledge Management, written by a previous PhD student of mine, who some of you might know. He worked also as part-time teacher here in Jøvik until, I think, last December. He's now working with a consulting company all the time and doesn't have time to teach. This is another article that we wrote together when he was a PhD student, Towards Viable Information Security Reporting Systems. I can also recommend you to read that. And since it is has a lot of detail, you don't need to so much explanation from me. But if you have questions, email me. Then I would like to go to a new topic, which is about high reliability organizations. It's about resilience, organizations that cope with the unexpected very well. Okay, so I think I prefer to do that in my PowerPoint slide. So this term, high reliability organization, resulted from studies that we have done at the University of California in Berkeley. They were curious about why some organizations perform very well, even at high risk. They were very reliable under very risky conditions. And that's because they didn't have a choice. The consequences of malfunctioning will be terrible. Examples of such high reliability organizations, they are nuclear reactors. Considering the number of nuclear reactors that are in the world and the danger, then very rarely something has happened. We have the Three Mile Islands accident in the United States, something like, I think it was in the 70s. We had Chernobyl in the 80s, and we had the case in Japan with the tsunami, which was less a question of malperformance of the nuclear reactor itself as the consequence of a terrible natural disaster, still indicating bad planning because they made the assumption that the tsunami's height will not be dangerous for the nuclear reactor, although there were records, historical records, that gigantic tsunamis had occurred before. So sooner or later, some tsunami could happen that will overflow the nuclear reactor. And that had terrible consequences for Japan. The problems are still persisting. These nuclear reactors are not under control, and radioactive pollution is still continuing there. But apart from these three cases, there haven't been serious accidents in the hundreds and hundreds of nuclear reactors in the world. Other case, there are nuclear aircraft carriers, aircraft operation systems, emergency medical treatment teams, and firms that are continuously working, processing, where a short interruption means a lot of costs. In fact, you could consider here the offshore operations, because one day break in an offshore plant in one of the platforms. If it's small, it's in the order of 30 to 40 million crowns. If it's a big platform, can be as much as 200 million crowns. So high reliability organizations are characterized by being very, very reliable, even under difficult and risky conditions. Very good book was written by Wake and Sutcliffe. They are experts in this area. The book is called Managing the Unexpected. There they show that there are five principles that all these high reliability organizations have adopted and implemented in practice. They recommend that these principles should be adopted by any enterprise that wants to manage the risk well and perform very well with high reliability. These principles can be divided in two. Some of them are about anticipation risk of risks, of known risks. That is how to prevent towards known risk, and if they happen, how to diminish the consequences, mitigate them. But then there are things that you cannot anticipate. They are the unknowns, unknowns. You don't know what it is, and they are unknown on two respects. First of all, because we don't know, even if we knew about them, we don't know how that occurs. But then we know so little, we don't even know that it could happen. So they are completely unexpected. And organizations should build up resilience so that if something happens, they are able to absorb the shock, diminish the consequences, and recover from the unexpected. The five principles of high reliability organizations are the first three, which are about anticipating, being aware, being preoccupied that failures occur and can occur. Two, and that's different from what I recommend when it's modeling, where you should simplify. In terms of considering the reality in a dangerous area, you should be reluctant to simple ideas, to simple solutions. So look for that reality might be more difficult than you believe. The third one is having a balance between the strategic, the planning long time, and the operational part, which is attending to what is happening from day to day. Then the fourth is commit to build up the resistance, the robustness of the system, which is called the resilience. And the last one is deference to expertise. What that means, I will explain a little bit later below. Preoccupation with failure. It's actually about what we talk about incident reporting systems. For every real big failure, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of small failures that do not escalate to a big failure, because a big failure often requires that several things happen together. This is done in aviation reporting systems. For instance, the crew is asked to record what things that happened that shouldn't have happened, even if that doesn't lead to real problems. And then this should be analyzed. Why did it happen? And what did we learn from that? How can we prevent that and disseminate the lessons? So to this, you have to encourage the crews, the staffs, the team to report and to follow up with analysis and dissemination of insights. In fact, that goes as far that high resilience organizations think that is fishy if they don't see failures. They interpret this as the staff feeling safe without a reason, which is known as complacent. They are satisfied with themselves rather than being alert that errors can happen or unexpected things can happen. So this is a false sense of security. The second principle is the reluctance to simplify. So all the time, the high resilience organizations encourage to understand better, more complete, more detailed, what is happening and how they should behave if something happens. So they understand the world is complex, it changes, it is unstable, and things happen that you cannot predict. So therefore the high resilience organizations are designed so that the staff is always learning and understanding new things. In particular, if things happen, they should be understood, not just say, oh, that has happened before, they are familiar. Therefore, when the analysis and understanding says, okay, this happens, but we understand that and that doesn't have problems. But very often they do discover unfamiliar aspects. So for instance, the famous accident in the United States with the spaceship, Ruhmsonde, I forgot what the English name is, that exploded a few minutes after being launched because there was a leakage of gas. They had detected these leakages before, but nothing had happened, and they simply decided, oh, that's a familiar problem, that doesn't have cause consequences, we have seen that before, nothing happened, rather than taking as a sign that something was as it shouldn't be, and therefore this discovery exploded and the whole crew was killed. The third principle of high resilience organizations is to be sensitive to the front line. So high resilience organizations rely less on strategic decisions that are long-term decisions, and they pay more attention to the situation as opposed to how most organizations do. Most organizations work on autopilot, they have a strategy, they follow that, and they don't change the strategy easily. Whereas high resilience organizations are prone to revise the strategy on the light of new experiences on the front line. So they put more value on situational awareness, and they like to continuously improve such awareness and react to that. So these were the first three principles related to anticipation: preoccupation with failure, reluctance to simplify, and sensitivity to operations, number 1, 2, 3. Now we go to 4 and 5, commitment to resilience and deference to expertise. Commitment to resilience. So resilience means that the system is able to preserve what is critical for its mission, what is needed so that it can continue performing when unexpected things happen. So to do this, the high resilience organizations plan for that. They have surplus capability that can be used in such situation. Perhaps They have duplication of the essential function so that if one is damaged, they can use the other one. They have planned for resources so that they can continue operations after a major accident or mishap, and or allow them to perform well even if they are suffering something. For this, they need capability to detect when something happens, to contain it so that it doesn't grow too large, and to be able to restore, to bounce back. And they simply assume this is going to happen sooner or later, because the world is not, cannot be predicted in all aspects. Finally, the deference to expertise. The high resilience organizations, they are concerned with having different expertises that can be used. The more complex environment, the more diversity you need. And they also make the hierarchies flexible. So rather than saying the boss is the one that decides what is going to happen, they push the decision making so that they are made on the front line. It is the persons who know best in the particular situation, no matter their level in the hierarchy, who should take the command. So authority is not fixed once and forever. Rather, it's flexible and it moves so that the people who are best to deal with the new things should be able to make decisions, regardless of the place in the hierarchy. So this is other principles of high resilience organizations, and that's an area of great importance, also an area where there is a lot of research. If you look at the research programs that you can apply for in the New Horizon 2020, high resilience and high reliability are very important aspects. Questions? So how would you, do you know some high resilient organizations, Steiner? In Norway? Which one would you consider to be? Well, if you look at the, if you look at what is happening offshore, have you heard of terrible accidents that happen offshore? In Norway, yes. And that's because you are so young. But there was in 19, let me see, when was that? In 1976 or so, then Norway had perhaps had oil and gas for about 8 years. There was an accident called the Bravo, I think, with some fire, and it took some weeks to stop that. Then in the 80s, there was this accident, terrible accident, where one leg of a platform broke off and the platform turned around. I forgot what the name of the platform was. That was perhaps the worst accident. Ekofisk. Was it Ekofisk? No, it was not Ekofisk. Yes. 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 But Bravo, there was a fire, wasn't it? Yes, a blowout. Yes, yes. Blowout with the oil escaping, leakage. I thought there was a sapphire associated with that. In the beginning, in 1976, I think it was the blowout, the Bravo, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
But then there was in the 80s, the platform legs that broke, but what was the name again of that? Yes, in the beginning of the 80s, there was a terrible accident where a platform turned around after a leg of the platform broke in a storm. The smaller ones, yes. Most of these accidents, they haven't had so much consequences, and especially the big ones happened a long time ago. So probably operations in offshore, in the Norwegian offshore, are now performed under conditions that come close to high reliability organizations. And if you consider information security accidents, very little has happened. If we believe in the reports, but everything points in the direction that security is very good. On the other hand, we have to ask ourselves if there is a false sense of security. What has happened to all these operators that are not experiencing so big problems? Perhaps they believe and feel safe, and the threat might be increasing. So we had a study, which I can show you now. That's the next topic. As to information security in the offshore. This one. Maintaining security and safety in high threat integrated operation transitions. Alexander Hill, yes, that was the one, exactly, yes. So if we look now at security, safety and risk in offshore, so what has happened is that one has been moving the offshore operations to onshore remote control operations, and it has got the name integrated operations because it integrates everything. The consequence of this was that staff offshore was reduced by at least 40%, perhaps even more. One has saved a lot and has extended the lifetime of the fields by at least 5 years or more. The increase in wealth for Norway was estimated in the order of 4,000 billion. Billion is milliarder, thousands of millions of Norwegian crowns, which is quite a lot of money. But by introducing remote operation, then you introduce new risks. So we try to understand in our study that we did, funded by the Norwegian Research Council, how is the dynamics of risk. So, among other things, the transition to integrated operations could be done in different ways. Are there decisions that generate more risk? And how would that influence the possibility to develop, enable, and to sustain integrated operations. So we use system dynamics, and we employed group model building, which I told you about that in a previous class. So we have workshops under facilitators where we work together with the experts from the old companies to develop system dynamic models. And the issues is to agree, to develop consensus, to if there are things that there is disagreement, finding out what is the cause of disagreement until we understand the problem better and people agree. Problem identification and focus, what to do. We had two workshops with experts in oil production, experts in information security, and experts in risk motivation. The project started in 2005 and ran for 3 years. And what we assume is that the following happens. We are going over from the traditional operations in platforms to integrated operations that are conducted a lot remotely. So this is this transition. This requires knowledge in order to do well. You have experience from traditional knowledge. We are generating new knowledge. And as this is integrated, we create new competencies. There is a knowledge gap between the required knowledge and the competence that has been developed. And the bigger this gap is, the more risk there it is. And because there are threats, damage can occur. So these damage are the incidents that occur related to information security. So that's the basic idea of the model. By going over to from working only in platforms to operating remotely using digital services, you create a new situation that requires more knowledge. Your knowledge that you have is based on your old experience. You have to develop new knowledge and new competencies. And if the difference between what you require and what you have is there, if there is a gap, this creates a risk. And because there is a risk, there's a probability for damage. But then the operation centers, also known as collaborative workspaces, they allow the exchange between the understanding of what is happening offshore and the knowledge that you need to develop this. So these two transitions of processes and knowledge, they are coupled to each other, and we have reinforcing loops that allow to manage the work process and capacity gap and the knowledge gap. The problem is that one had some resistance in the operators and the staff to change. So because of this resistance to change, you see here, you can get a reinforcing loop that fuels the knowledge gap, increases the risk, increases the fear of breaches, increases the resistance to change, and diminishes the effectiveness of the collaborative workspaces. So that was one of the problems that we identified. Already after the first workshop, we had some insights that can be summarized in that the transition create knowledge and process gaps that increase risk. That the dynamics of these risks can have two effects. If you do it worse, you get too much risk, and the resistance to change make it harder to be dried. Whereas if you do it well, it will make the later transitions easier. But there are misperceptions of risk. You can underinvest. You don't find risk because you don't see them, you don't look. You can overinvest. You can be over zealous and see too many dangers, and in this case also blocking the transition, blocking the production. So this can lead to underinvestment in risk management, and therefore you can get traps to mitigate. We recommended the companies that we were working together to invest more in understanding, in data collection, but also in modeling, so that you could explore different scenarios. Then we developed models that we could simulate and that we could explore different scenarios. What we could assume was that to begin with, the gap in knowledge and work process was small, that it will increase over time, and after 3 or 4 years it will start decreasing. That was at the time of the first implementations in offshore. Then we could also make models for capacity of operations with new work processes. We could also consider new knowledge and be simulations of this. So as you can see, it's about capacity, it's about work processes, it's about knowledge. And then we had simulation models. This is still a simplified version, where we related security procedures, technology transitions, processes and developing of knowledge to the frequency and of incidents and so on, and how to learn from that. So the purpose with these models was partly to be able to do simulations, but partly also to increase the understanding of the companies as to the situation that they were facing. And what I show you here is a high level picture so that you get an idea as to how this was done. I don't expect you to understand all the details. That's not the point of this. It's more that you see an example in practice of how we work when we use system dynamics models for industry. We had a project that included my university, University of Agder, included SINTEF, included the organization called ULF, and that is Oljeforeningens Landsforbund, eller noe sånt, ULF, and the funding was partly from the Research Council and partly from ULF. And our partner was mainly, there were two platforms, pilot projects, that at that time were run by Norsk Hydro. Norsk Hydro at that time was still an oil producer. Then the part of Norsk Hydro dealing with oil and gas was segregated, and it went into Statoil. For a while the company was called Hydro Statoil, and then again Hydro was eliminated. It's called only Statoil. So that gives you some ideas. Again, my point is not so much that you should from this become experts in oil and gas security. Rather, the key ideas of this is that the risk is related to gaps. And the gaps is because when you are making a transition from operating the old way in platforms to operating in with operation centers where you have the management in onshore centers using all kind of channels of communication and information and teams working together, then you have to reshape the processes of oil and gas. You have to reshape the technology. You need new knowledge, and what you need compared with what you have, there are gaps in knowledge, there are gaps in processes, there are gaps in technology, and all these gaps create risks. And therefore, we made simulations as to show how you could diminish this risk over time. So what kind of investment you should do. Questions? Okay, then we can take a break, and then I will have only one more hour, and then we finish. So perhaps we need also some questions and answers. I wonder how many students that are.